Hello and welcome back to The Fall of the Roman Empire. My name is Nick Holmes and this is episode 35, called Keeping the Show on the Road. In the last episode, the Emperor Julian was killed in a skirmish and his army was left stranded beside the Tigris in Persian territory. His great Persian expedition had proved a failure, but worse was to follow. As mentioned in the last episode, Julian left no successor, and it was up to the army to proclaim a new emperor. There were basically two factions in the army, Constantius's former officials and Julian's Gallic officers. Since Constantius and Julian had been enemies, these two factions were fairly hostile to each other. But there was one person they all admired, and this was Salutius, Julian's trusted second-in-command. So they agreed to offer the throne to him. Unfortunately, Salutius was a wise old man and turned the offer down, presumably guessing that it would only bring grief. Next, they offered it to another compromise candidate, Jovian, the commander of Julian's guard, who accepted. Thus began the short reign of Jovian, widely regarded as one of the most disastrous in late Roman history. And the reason for this was that he negotiated a humiliating peace with Chapur. Now, Ammianus, our most trusted source on Julian, says that Julian's army had inflicted heavy losses on the Persians, and the army was incensed by Julian's death, so much so that it was, quote, set upon avenging its illustrious chief rather than upon self-preservation, and intended to extricate itself from its pressing difficulties by either complete victory or a glorious death, end quote. Chapur was aware of this and didn't want to engage the Romans in battle. Ammianus goes on to say that Jovian could have led the army to safety, since a fertile region called Corduene was only 100 miles away where the army could have recuperated. But Jovian was not incentivized to save the army's honour or to honour Julian's reputation. Instead, he seems to have been motivated purely by a wish for self-preservation. This meant that when Chapur sent envoys to negotiate a treaty, he caved in far too easily. The deal that was hammered out was a virtual Roman capitulation on its eastern frontier, in exchange for the army being allowed to cross the Tigris and limp back to Antioch. Chapur demanded the cities of Nisibis and Singara, as well as the five satrapies, as the Persian provinces were called, that Diocletian had taken from Persia 60 years before. Peace for 30 years was also agreed. Hostages were exchanged to ensure that the terms of the treaty were kept. It was, in effect, a complete reversal of the Treaty of Nisibis in 299, by which Diocletian had established Roman domination over Persia in the east. Indeed, Jovian's treaty in 363 became known as the Second Peace of Nisibis. The Romans also promised not to intervene in Armenia, which meant it also fell under Persian sway. In fact, Chapur invaded the kingdom shortly afterwards, and the Armenian king Arshak II was imprisoned, never to leave the so-called Castle of Oblivion to which he was confined. Another point which Ammianus is keen to highlight is that the humiliating peace didn't achieve anything for the Romans. This was because not only did he think that the Roman army could have withdrawn to the safety of Roman territory anyway, but he also stressed that even after the treaty, the Roman retreat was still very costly, resulting, quote, in loss of life on a large scale, end quote. This was because the Persians didn't supply the Romans with food, the shortage of which was the main problem they faced. In addition, they picked off stragglers and any Romans who unwisely wandered off too far in search of provisions. Roman morale also seems to have broken down with a chaotic crossing of the Tigris, in which many soldiers drowned. Jovian's popularity suffered another setback when, safely back in Roman territory, he had the audacity to say that the peace represented a Roman victory. This was simply going too far. The citizens of Nisibis, who were forced to evacuate the city before handing it over empty to the Persians, were so outraged that they stoned to death one of Jovian's senior officers. When the army limped back to Antioch, its citizens couldn't conceal their anger and rioted against him. It's intriguing to speculate what might have happened had Jovian chosen to fight his way out. If Ammianus was right, then the army might have fended the Persians off, perhaps even defeating them. Who knows? And the status quo before Julian set out might have been preserved. But the reality was that Rome had now lost its dominant position in the east, and this can, I think, be regarded as the first step on the path towards the fall of the Roman Empire. As for Jovian, he never got very far after concluding his treaty. Just as caving into Shapur was intended to preserve his authority, so in his short reign he tried to appease as many of the factions in the late Roman Empire as possible. He was a Christian, and he made it his aim to secure the support of the powerful Christian communities by repudiating Julian's pagan sympathies. Nevertheless, he also courted favour with the pagans, for example, by sacrificing and consulting the omens in Persia before offering his peace terms to Shapur. Jovian was still keen to try to take control of the empire that he'd been elected by the generals to lead, but there were plenty of signs of disquiet brewing against him. Not only the riots against him in Nisibis and Antioch, as I've just mentioned, but in Gaul when he sent his father-in-law Lucilianus to take over from Julian's commander. He was murdered by the troops in a mutiny. Things weren't looking promising for Jovian, so he left Antioch for Constantinople to stamp his authority as emperor on what was effectively the capital of the empire. But he never made it. He died in February 364 in Ankara, apparently asphyxiated in a fire in the house he was staying in. Ammianus says there was a cover-up about the true cause of death, and I think it's highly likely he was murdered by his own soldiers, who'd realised they'd made a mistake in making him emperor. There was now a power vacuum in Roman politics, since there was no obvious successor to Jovian. The senior army officers who'd accompanied Jovian on his way to Constantinople turned first to Julian's favourite Salutius, just as they'd done immediately after Julian's death. But again, Salutius turned them down, presumably because, like the last time, he felt he was too old for the job. Instead, the throne was offered to a senior army officer called Valentinian, who was the tribune of an elite infantry regiment called the Scutarii. To be honest, Valentinian had little that was striking to commend him, and his choice basically reflects a serious lack of suitable and capable candidates for the throne. However, he jumped at the opportunity and quickly appointed his brother Valens as his co-emperor, although definitely in a junior role to him. For the next 10 years, Valentinian and Valens did a decent job of keeping the empire together, although it was very much a case of keeping the show on the road rather than reinvigorating the empire as had been Julian's dream. And in the end, as I think you probably know, Valens would go down in history as the man who sent the empire into a death spiral when he was crushingly defeated by the Goths at the crucially important Battle of Adrianople in 378. But before we get to that, let's look at the 15 years leading up to that battle when, to be honest, Valentinian and Valens managed to keep things going reasonably well. Their first action was to divide the empire between them, with Valentinian taking the west and Valens the east. However, almost immediately there was a challenge to their authority. This was probably because they were just a little too heavy-handed in trying to remove some of Julian's supporters, and when they tried to arrest his cousin Procopius, the one who you remember had mysteriously failed to come to Julian's aid in his ill-fated Persian campaign, he escaped to the Crimea. There he plotted against them. He arrived in Constantinople in September 365 after Valens had left the city and set up a rival government claiming legitimacy due to his Constantinian ancestry. And he seems to have had reasonable support among both the people of Constantinople and the army, which included two Thracian legions, suggesting that Valens was not particularly well-liked. Meanwhile, Valentinian in the west decided not to go to his brother's aid, preferring to keep his troops guarding the western frontiers, and, according to Ammianus, saying, quote, Procopius was merely his own and his brother's enemy, whereas the Alemanni were the enemies of the whole Roman world, end quote. For a while, it seemed as if Procopius's power was growing, especially when he occupied Bithynia and appealed to the Goths to send him troops. But Valens was also busy on his side, persuading the Eastern army to back him. Given that Julian had probably never fully won over the Eastern army's support, which had previously supported Constantius, and that Procopius was, of course, Julian's cousin, the bulk of the Eastern army opted to support Valens. And this enabled him to muster sufficient forces to advance on Constantinople and defeat and execute Procopius. So Procopius was the last of the Constantinian dynasty, and after his death, Valentinian and Valens were not challenged as co-emperors again. However, this didn't mean to say that there weren't external threats. Indeed, there were lots and lots of them. Valentinian faced an almost continual war with the Alemanni along the Rhine, together with a growing Saxon menace in the English Channel, and then a full-blown collapse of Roman rule in Britain and North Africa. So starting with the Alemanni, as I mentioned, Valentinian didn't help Valens fight Procopius because he was so seriously worried about the Alemanni, who had recovered their mojo after Julian's victory over them at the Battle of Strasbourg in 357. In 365, they crossed the Rhine and invaded Gaul. Valentinian preferred to send his generals to fight them rather than risk the reputational disgrace of defeat himself, and these had little success. Two generals, Charieto and Severianus, were defeated and killed. It was only when another general called Jovinus took command that the Alemanni were finally pushed out of Gaul. At the same time, in 367, there was a full-scale collapse of Roman rule in Britain called the Great Conspiracy, since it involved a three-way invasion by the Picts from Scotland, Irish tribes sailing across from Ireland, or Hibernia as the Romans called it, together with Saxons sailing from Germany. In addition, the Roman army in Britain joined the revolt in some places, probably since it hadn't been paid, and large elements of it had also been withdrawn to fight along the Rhine. Indeed, apparently the few legionaries still on Hadrian's Wall conspired with the Picts to invite them in and share their plunder. When this invasion happened, Valentinian was still preoccupied with the Alemanni and could do little other than send Jovinus to reconnoitre the situation. But in 368, Valentinian won a solid victory over the Alemanni at the Battle of Solicinium, with himself actually in command of the army at this time. This meant that in 368 he could send an army to recover Britain, which was led by Count Flavius Theodosius, the father of the future Emperor Theodosius the Great. This included some elite legionary and auxiliary units and was able to retake Londinium and then fairly rapidly push the Picts back over Hadrian's Wall and expel the Irish and Saxons. Indeed, the fact that this was achieved within not much more than a year suggests that the invaders had probably taken what plunder they wanted and were happy to go back home. A wise move of Theodosius's was to grant an amnesty to Roman army deserters who were allowed back to their posts. The success of the recovery of Britain prompted Valentinian to make Theodosius his senior general, the Magister Equitum. And as such, Valentinian used Theodosius to lead further military expeditions, first against the Alemanni in 370, and then against the Sarmatians in Illyria in 371. And his last campaign was in North Africa, where there was also a complete breakdown of Roman rule. This was because a corrupt Roman governor called Romanus was abusing his power by forcing towns to pay him protection money against the Berber tribesmen. What Romanus did was to agree with the Berbers that they should or should not attack towns according to whether they agreed to participate in the extortion racket. He would then pocket the money and give some of it to the Berbers. This outrageous abuse of power prompted a rebellion by the Roman inhabitants against him, led by a Berber Numidian prince called Firmus. While Firmus was in fact claiming to be the champion of the Romans against their corrupt governor, a bit like an African Robin Hood, Valentinian had no choice but to send Theodosius to restore order. Taking legions from Pannonia and Moesia, Theodosius landed in Mauritania, which is what the Romans called modern-day Tunisia and Algeria, and arrested Romanus and then found himself fighting a difficult guerrilla style of war with Firmus, who retreated into the African interior. Finally, the redoubtable Theodosius tracked Firmus down and captured him in 374. And it's worth mentioning that Count Theodosius is significant not just for these campaigns, which held together most of the western half of the empire in the late 360s and early 370s, but also because he laid the foundations for the future Theodosian dynasty, in that his son, also called Theodosius, would later follow his father in rising through the ranks of the Roman army, so that after the disaster of the Battle of Adrianople, he was able to succeed Valens as Eastern Emperor. But before we get to that, we need to finish with Valentinian's story, which has an almost comic or tragic end to it, depending on which version you prefer. So, the African revolt was another source of irritation for Valentinian, who was still hard-pressed on the Rhine and Danube frontiers. In 373, the German tribe called the Quadi, who were living on the upper Danube south of the Alemanni, protested against Valentinian's policy of building forts on the east side of the Rhine and Danube rivers. Both the Alemanni and Quadi regarded this as their territory, although to be honest, what Valentinian was doing was probably a fairly sensible attempt to strengthen the Roman frontier. And then a curious sequence of events unfolded, in which the Quadi sent deputations to the Roman governor in Pannonia protesting about Valentinian's programme of fort building on what they regarded as their land. The Roman governor, Marcellianus, invited them to a grand banquet to settle their differences, only to trick them and murder the Quadi king, Gabinius. This was broadly in keeping with the Romans' disrespect for the Germans as barbarians, but was not a particularly clever move, since several of the legions defending that part of the frontier had been sent to Africa to deal with the rebellion there. Accordingly, the Quadi joined with the Sarmatians, crossed the Danube, tried to hunt down Marcellianus, and began pillaging Roman territory south of the Danube. Valentinian was, not surprisingly, not too happy when he heard of Marcellianus's incompetence and was forced to gather legions from the Rhine and march to the Danube to restore order. The Quadi and Sarmatians retreated back over the Danube and requested a peace treaty with Valentinian. They insisted on an audience with Valentinian himself, which he reluctantly agreed to. However, at this meeting, the Quadi, probably quite justifiably, claimed that this war had been started by Marcellianus's treachery in killing their king. They also reiterated their opposition to Valentinian's policy of building forts on what they considered to be their land. Now, Valentinian was not the sort of emperor who you would have wanted to get into a lift with, if the Romans, of course, had had lifts, which they didn't. Because according to Ammianus, he was famous for losing his temper, as well as being capable of extreme cruelty. For example, apparently he kept two bears in an iron cage, which he took with him on his journeys, and servants who displeased him were put in the iron cage to be ripped apart by the bears. Indeed, Ammianus tells us that the morning he went to see the Quadi delegation, he was in a particularly bad mood, and when he had difficulty mounting his horse, which reared repeatedly, he ordered that the groom holding the horse should have his right hand cut off. Now, very fortunately for the young groom, the tribune of the stables deferred the sentence, and Valentinian set off to meet the Quadi, where their insistence that they had been wronged by the Romans and not the other way around started to make his temper rise. Indeed, according to Ammianus, their behaviour brought on a paroxysm of anger in the emperor, and beginning his reply to them, quote, boiling with fury, end quote, he literally passed out, collapsed on the floor, and within a few hours was proclaimed dead. So Valentinian passed into history as the only Roman emperor to literally die from losing his temper. He was 54 years old and had reigned for just under 12 years. Now, leaving aside the comedy or the tragedy of his death, whichever version you prefer, and I sense most Romans preferred the former, Valentinian's reign in the West had actually been reasonably successful. Faced with incessant warfare along the Rhine and Danube, together with a collapse of Roman government in Britain and North Africa, he'd kept the show on the road. But he certainly wasn't the sort of gifted leader like Aurelian and Diocletian, and the Romans now particularly needed good leaders because it was looking increasingly likely that the crisis of the 3rd century was about to be rerun. For not only were the Persians dominant in the east, but as you've just heard, the empire in the west was facing a host of barbarians. And if that wasn't bad enough, there was one German tribe who'd been suspiciously quiet since the 3rd century. And these were the Goths. For the Goths were now massing along the lower Danube, ready for a repeat of those great invasions of the 3rd century when they'd sacked Athens and overrun the Balkans and Greece. Of course, in the 3rd century, they'd eventually been roundly defeated by the soldier emperors like Claudius Gothicus, Aurelian and Diocletian. But now, in round two, they were facing Valentinian's brother Valens. And unfortunately for the Romans, Valens would not go down in history as a great soldier emperor. And that ends this episode. Thanks so much for listening, and I hope you enjoyed it. And if you did, of course, I'd be delighted for any ratings or reviews in whichever podcast app you use. And next week, we'll continue with the story of Valens and the Goths. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.